the Bumblecast, everyone. I am your host, Ian Flynn, the Bumble King, and joining me as always is my pit crew chief, Kyle Kraus.
Hello!
Hi, Ian. We have a special show lined up for today, don't we, Kyle?
Oh, yes.
It's a show where we talk about things.
It's a
new
thing.
And exciting, I know.
It's a thing where we talk about shows. Wait, no. That's, that's backwards.
That's been a lot of other shows, actually.
Yes.
So let's just move on straight to the main topic. I believe you had something to give us, a driving narrative, if you will.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah. So we're just going to shift gears and move on to the main topic?
Yeah.
Are you getting exhausted with all these leading questions?
Let's drive right into it.
Yeah, there we go.
We're talking about racing games today.
Yeah.
A topic near and dear to my heart, very close to me. I think you have some appreciation for certain racing games, Ian.
I'm more of a kart racer.
Well,
I'm not
yeah.
a biggest race car game player guy, but, you know, the alternative intro I had for this is just going, "Welcome to Bumblecast!"
Yes! Hey, man, kart racers are racing games as far as I am concerned.
But let's start off with you and your favorites, because this is something you're passionate about.
Yes, I do quite enjoy racing games. Favorites to start off. Where do I start?
I mean, the starting line.
I mean, oh man, there are so many puns in this episode. I think people have already left by the thousands. And we don't even have thousands of listeners.
We have retroactively lost people.
We have lost people. It's like future listeners are dropping off.
So we just better pit stop it.
Anyway, yes. Racing games. Favorites. Daytona, USA is probably the best place to start, I think.
Daytona! Daytona! Kyle's favorite game!
Daytona. One of my favorite games, yes. Yes. Love me some Daytona, USA. It's a classic. Sega classic, too, so hey, it's fitting of this show.
When was the first one? Was that like an original Master System game?
No, it was an arcade game in 1993. That was the original Daytona USA.
Okay.
There were precursors sort of leading up to it. Virtua Racing was also an arcade game. Used similar technology and had some of the same people working on it. It's developed by AM2, who were arcade masters back in the day. But the AM does not stand for arcade master, although it should. But, yeah, Daytona, I loved. I think going back even earlier than Daytona, one of my first racing games was probably... Oh, man. I mean, there were certain games on the NES that I was playing. Like, there was a Bigfoot game, Bigfoot the Monster Truck. That game was pretty cool. But I think the first racing game that really left an impression on me was Super Mario Kart.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be a big one for a lot of people.
Yeah. And I mean, I grew up, my father's really into car racing and cars in general. So I grew up around cars and sort of the culture of all of that. So I was, already pretty excited about cars and car racing. And then... You give me a game where Mario's racing around, and I'm like, yes, this is the best game ever made.
But what is it about Daytona itself that stands out to you?
Daytona? Well, the music, of course.
Mm. Your I other mean... passion in life.
True, yes. The music is legendary in its, quintessential cheesiness, I suppose. It is... simultaneously cheesy and brilliant, I'd say. I am a huge fan of it. Takanobu Mitsuyoshi is the original composer, and I know some fans out there may know him more for his work on Shenmue, which is a lot more serious in tone, and stuff like Sega Rally, which is just more rock-oriented, and there's no vocals. Not many vocals, at least, in Sega Rally, but Daytona USA is kind of where he... blew up, I suppose, where he got his big break, and that's just one of the things I really love about it. Also, the gameplay is a lot of fun. It is in no way representative of real life stock car racing, but that's fine. A lot of it is drifting, sliding around corners. There's, yeah, that's really not a thing that happens in real life. But you know what? It's fun. It's just kind of that
middle ground between your cartoony kart racers and your more realistic Gran Turismos.
Yeah.
So that you've got realistic cars, but they're driving in ways that are fun and not necessarily precision realism.
Yeah, and I think that's the most fun I generally have with racing games is when they're more arcade-oriented, maybe stuff that's more based on real life, but is, you know, just more fun. Not to say that I don't enjoy a good simulation racing game, but I think the most fun I have is with an arcade-style game.
See, I've never been really big into racing games, the mm-hmm. stuff like your Gran Turismo and the ones that really hinge on realism.
Yeah.
I can appreciate it, and I understand why folks do really enjoy that level of recreation, because video games are escapist fantasy in every form, and this is, you know, if you really like really pretty, really fast cars, there you go. It's wish fulfillment. But to me, I'm not a big car enthusiast,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure a lot of North Carolinians are kind of recoiling and hissing and saying, you live in a city with the NASCAR Hall of Fame. You have betrayed us.
You live in, North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina, sort of like NASCAR Central almost.
Yeah.
That and Daytona.
But I don't know, it just never really appealed to me, in part because I'm absolutely awful at it. You know, any of those hairpin turns or moderately wide turns or not a straight line. Okay, let's be honest. Even a straight line, I'm plowing into walls and stuff because, you know, physics.
Drag racing is hard.
That's why I think the more kart racy type games appeal to me, because it's built around the idea of you're going to be bouncing off walls and being blown up, and it doesn't hinge entirely on your racing skill, but also your item management.
Yeah.
So as long as I got that blue shell in my pocket, I think I can be okay.
There was a pretty fun arcade racing game that came out a few years ago. It's one of the last arcade racers I can even think of, because kind of aside from Mario Kart and maybe a few random smaller releases here and there, unfortunately, the arcade racing genre especially is kind of dead in the water at the moment, which is unfortunate, but...
Well, arcades in general seem to have gone by the way of the dinosaur, unfortunately, but...
Right, but arcade racing is kind of... It's just the style of it, not necessarily the fact that it came from the arcades or anything.
True.
But there was a game that came out a few years ago called Blur.
Ah, yes.
And it is a arcade-style racing game using real licensed cars, but they have items that you pick up, and so you have, like, missiles and boosts and stuff like that. And it was a really fun game and really pretty game, but unfortunately it didn't do so well. It was one of the games that sort of killed the genre at the moment.
The studio got shut down,
which is really unfortunate, because I think it's the same studio that also developed Project Gotham Racing, which is another great arcade style racing game.
I wonder if Blur was just trying to appeal to too many people at once, because it had the fun gimmicks of your kart racers, but your realistic cars of Gran Turismo, and then your very Tron-like aspects visually, and I don't know, maybe it just, there were enough elements on either side that it pushed more people away than it invited in? I don't know. I thought it was delightful fun.
Yeah, I'm not really sure where it went wrong exactly, because it was definitely a lot of fun, but there was another game that came out around the same time, and they were actually sort of spirited competitors because they came out at almost the same time, and a game that I really love is Split Second, or Split Second Velocity for our European listeners.
That's the one that's based around movie scenes, right? That it's more that you're like a stunt driver?
Kind of. It's more like reality TV series mixed with arcade racing, which I actually really quite enjoyed that concept. Unfortunately, because between both the limited budget and the time that they were given, they couldn't explore the entire concept too much in depth. So you get this sort of arcade racing game couched with maybe a couple of trappings of reality TV, but you don't really get in depth. There's like no characters or anything, which I think they were planning on expanding on in the sequel, but that never came to be. So, but basically what it is racing through a Michael Bay movie. instead of having items, you, when you drive around, you build up a meter by drifting and doing special stunts and stuff, to trigger explosions and to trigger destruction to try and thwart your enemies as you drive along. So it was a really cool concept. I really enjoyed it, but I would have liked to have seen a sequel, but unfortunately, again, another game where the studio got shut down after it was done.
That is too bad.
Yeah.
Although, the way that you describe it, I would imagine if you've got your meter filled and you just sit on it until somebody comes around a bend where you know dodging out of the way is not much of an option, and then you drop away the ground or blow it up or drop a building on it.
Yeah.
And it brings to mind a session I had in Mario Kart DS with my best friend, Jeffrey. Jeffrey, if you're listening, this goes out to you. We were playing Mario Kart. We were having a grand old time. And Jeffrey is usually far better at video games than I am. He's done some legendary stuff I should tell you about sometime. But we're racing, mano a mano, doing pretty well. Had a fun thing where somebody fired off a red shell and it glitched into the map. So on the mini-map on the bottom of the screen, the shell just kind of went away.
Nice.
But I'm surprised because I am just kicking his butt. I am well in the lead. I've been maintaining the lead for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dominating. Since when did Jeff ever lose? And that, as I saw the finish line approach on my third lap, realized he has a blue shell, doesn't he? And right as I thought that, I heard the whisper of that winged doom coming in. Blew me up within 5 feet of the line, and he cruised right past. He had that in his pocket since lap one.
Yeah.
And he... I don't think I've ever seen the man laugh that hard. It was a good time, though. I must give him props. I totally thought I was winning, and then... The Valkyrie shell. You lose a race.
That's one reason why I hate the blue shell, but that's just me.
See, did you play? Get a chance to play the Mario Kart 8?
Oh, yeah. I've played it extensively, and I love it. Even with the blue shell and everything, it's all good.
Well, see, that's why I like the new horn item they introduced.
Yeah, there is at least a way to dispatch it.
And the thing is, it's not a immediate problem fixer.
Yeah.
If you don't hit the button in time, you're still getting blue shelled.
Yeah.
If you get tired of holding it in your pocket and decide to use it offensively, you're defenseless against a blue shell.
Yeah.
And it still serves a function aside from anti-blue shell. It's just this perfectly implemented new tool, and that makes me happy.
Yeah, they did a lot of really smart things with Mario Kart 8. I was really pleased with that one in particular.
To me, it almost feels like Mario Kart, at a point, just kind of flipped between this is really good and this is not so great. Like, all right, Super Mario Kart.
Right.
Excellent game. It started it all.
It obviously launched the whole concept of kart racers.
Mario Kart 64, that was my first. That one is, find a flaw. You can't. I'm sorry. And it's the only game still to have the best battle mode. This I think we can all agree on.
That is actually, yeah, that is true.
Next one was Mario Kart Advance.
Was Advance first or Double Dash?
I believe it was Advance.
Okay. Because
I think they went back to the retro style.
Yeah, yeah, they
did. I never
did.
Played that one, so I don't know how good that was.
I think it's Mario Kart Super Circuit is the actual name of it. But yeah, it was Game Boy Advance.
Okay.
But yeah, they went back to sort of the flat track Mode 7 style of Super Mario Kart, and it works. It's fun, but I don't really have the same memories of it that I do, especially Mario Kart 64 and Super Mario Kart.
Mm-hmm. Double Dash, the co-op mode was fun, but overall I felt it was lacking. Visually, I thought a lot of the new items were too gimmicky or not balanced at all, and not a lot of really memorable tracks in terms of music or racetracks.
Yeah, I think that was sort of my issue with Double Dash, where I didn't even buy it, because it was just like hinging too much on a gimmick that I really wasn't interested in, which was the double cart, which is kind of interesting, but I mean, it didn't really drive me to it. And yeah, I don't know. It just didn't really grab me for some reason. And I know that's going to be probably a shock and horror to a lot of people, because I know a lot of Double Dash fans who are really, really, really passionate about Double Dash, but I don't know. It just didn't grab me the same way. Like, Rainbow Road was even kind of disappointing comparison to Mario Kart 64.
And then it was Mario Kart DS that came next, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
And that one, to me, I felt like that was the savior of the franchise. That one was just a tight, excellently implemented Mario Kart. It had fantastic stages. The Clock Tower stage in particular, love that one.
Mario Kart DS was kind of the point where I was like, wait a minute, why is the AI cheating so much? I think they really like cranked up the AI and everything on the DS version, and I definitely enjoyed it, and a lot of the tracks were really awesome, but I was just like, man, this game is so much harder than like the previous ones. Because I remember I used to be able to really kick ass at Mario Kart 64. But for some reason, DS just, it just completely threw me off.
It was not gentle with you, no.
No, and it introduced snaking, which I still don't care for at all.
that is a point against.
Luckily that was mostly online, but still, it was one of those things where it's just like, oh, man.
And then we had Mario Kart 7, which introduced the new vehicle types, and I don't know, 7 didn't grab me either. It felt like, here are the new gimmicks, but the gameplay itself suffers.
7 fell a little flat, I will agree. I still like the amount of characters in it. There's quite a few characters, sure, which was nice. But yeah, it definitely did fall flat. But Mario Kart 8.
Oh, 8. That one, to me, is my Mario Kart DS of this iteration. Just the car styles, the characters, the DLC, the racetracks, everything.
The music.
Oh, the music.
The music is some of the best in the franchise, bar none, I would
Wario's
say.
Wario's Mountain stands out. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. You give me any racing game with a jazz fusion soundtrack, and I'm there. Mario Kart 8, Gran Turismo, the Japanese soundtracks anyway for Gran Turismo. Yeah, I'm there. Drift Stage, which maybe we'll talk about that one, but it's not even out yet.
That and the gimmick that they introduced for this one didn't feel like it was a hindrance or a distraction. It felt like a natural addition to the game. The track seemed built for the idea rather than, here's the racetrack, oh, and here's the 3D gimmick, or the zero-G gimmick.
Yeah, my only thing about that is it was their way of not making a new F-Zero game.
And here's what really confuses me, because there's a title out for the 3DS that's a downloadable by a small indie company where you have these futuristic rocket-shaped cars that go super ludicrously fast, that recharge shields over, you know, a light-colored bar, and your whole point is, you know, spinning around and bashing other cars off the track, but it's not F-Zero.
Yeah.
This is a company that told Rare to change their furry Legend of Zelda-esque game into a Star Fox game because there's foxes involved.
Was that
why not just make you come to this developer, say, hey, we will buy you and just make this F-Zero. You do all the grunt work. We'll give you some money and some props. Boom. F-Zero game. Done. Fans are happy. Why, Kyle? Why?
Well, they passed F-Zero GX off to Sega, so just do that again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, who has ever complained about F-Zero GX? Really?
Well, other than its extreme difficulty.
Right, but it's kind of that reverent. It's the same kind of like Dark Souls. It's too hard. It's like, oh man, this absolutely destroyed me. I better play it another 7 hours.
Yeah, that's definitely F-Zero GX's forte. Man, I love that game so much, though. F-Zero, I really miss F-Zero so much. Nintendo, Nintendo, you're killing me.
That, and it kind of had that old quirky 90s Sega feel to a lot of it, especially the little character videos that you got here and there that were just bizarre.
Oh, yeah.
Is this perfect fusion? So why don't we have more of it?
It's this very comic book style. It is very comic book style art, and I think it was actually originally inspired by sort of Western style comic books, at least in its character designs, which... I think it's pretty
good. Oh, yeah, it looks like the worst of the 90s, which is what makes it so fun.
I know, it looks great, I love it. It looks bad and great at the same time.
It's so bad, it's good.
Yes, that's exactly
it. It's so good because it's so bad.
Uh-huh, but hey, and it's futuristic car racing. I am totally down.
Right.
Yes. Oh, man. What other games, what other racing games have you enjoyed, Ian? What do you dabble in?
Well, I think it's apropos to mention Sega Sonic and Sega All-Star Racings, both the original and transformed.
Ah, yes, yes. Arguably better than Mario Kart in a lot of ways.
At least comparable.
Right.
Because it was a mascot racer with items, and it didn't feel like it was ashamed of any comparisons. It felt like, here's what we are, and we're going to do it, and it's going to be fun. That's all it was. It was just straight up fun. It was a pretty game. It was... filled with a lot of characters that I liked. Transformed gets huge markups for me because you have Vice.
Yeah.
And an entire Skies of Arcadia stage. I honestly got a little misty eye going through that one, Kyle. Mm-hmm. I'm like, there's that ship! And there's that ship! Ah! And Leia's going, that's nice, dear. That's nice. And huge props to Transformed because the whole changing from land to water to air, to land to water to air, etc., etc. I was like, how are you going to do that and not make... the console just chug along, you know? Never mind online play. How are you going to keep this at a minimum of 15 frames per second? And I don't know what wizardry they did, but the whole transformation thing is seamless. The tracks all are built, again, for it, like Mario Kart 8. It feels natural moving from one section to another. And for the most part, all this stuff going on in the background is fun to look at without being distracting. It's a fantastic racing game.
I feel like that series is kind of Sega's version of Super Smash Brothers. Like, it really is just this big company-wide crossover game in a way that actually is really very fitting of Sega, because racing games are one of the biggest things that they have going for them throughout their history, other than, you know, Sonic, obviously, and other things like that, but... their racing games are definitely quite popular, and it was really a good idea, I think, to mash them all up together in a racing game rather than sort of a fighting game.
That being said, I would love a Sonic and Sega All-Star Smash. Just call it that. Give it to me. I don't care. It's the exact same thing as Smash Brothers. Don't care. Want to play it? Give it to me.
Well, you could just do Fighters Mega Mix 2, which was basically a Sega company-wide fighting game using the Virtua Fighter engine.
Yeah, but see, Virtua Fighter is too close to an actual technical fighting game for my taste.
Well, yeah,
Smash Brothers, where it's, you know, A, B, up, down, left, right. There's nuance if you want it. Otherwise, button mash.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, do a Fighters Mega Mix 2. I mean, you know, just completely change everything about it. But, hey, call it Fighters Mega Mix 2. Just bring that name back. Why not?
While we're at it, let's bring back Sonic R.
Sonic R? Yeah, sure, why not? Cheesy music is like an all. I'm down.
I mean, I love it, but I know that there's problems with it, because the whole merging the platforming and level exploration with a racing game didn't quite work. And, you know, everybody kind of handles like a truck.
But yes.
I like the fact that, you know, you've got them on foot. Now, that also brings to mind the Sonic Riders series, which... unfortunately doesn't have the same pedigree as those other two. I mean, Sonic R has its blemishes, but it's kind of charming, like an ugly dog that's very friendly. It's like, you can't hate it. It's a happy dog. Riders? I don't know about Riders.
Riders, I think the first two were okay, but then the Kinect one, just the Kinect. Yeah, well, the Kinect itself, yeah.
I wasn't fond of the first game. I mean, the air mechanic is neat, and I like the way that the idea, at least, that you are rewarded for performing well with more fuel.
Mm-hmm.
I could not perform well. So there was more than one time where I was running on foot looking for a gas station just so I could play the game again.
Yeah.
I seem to be in the very few, small minority, I should say, of the people who really liked Zero Gravity, because I got the mechanic of the Zero G. I could just fly through those stages. I had a blast with Zero Gravity.
Yeah, I haven't actually even played Zero Gravity. I've only played the first one and seen the third one, which...
I played
kind of scary.
Freeriders. I bought a Kinect to play Freeriders.
Oh, that's yeah, like I remember that, yes, and you were not happy.
I was in an apartment that was fairly spacious. It had a large main room.
Mm-hmm.
I had the TV and everything set up on one wall. The couch pushed all the way against the opposite wall, and it still was reading my knees as my feet.
Yeah.
This was an old-style apartment, so there was no padding under the carpeting. It was carpet and concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who didn't know and have somehow avoided this game, you actually had to act like you were on the airboard. So you had to stand like you were on a skateboard.
Stand sideways, yeah.
If you wanted to turn, you had to bend and lean into the turns, and if you wanted to do any of the jumps, you actually had to physically jump. So multiple laps... jumping onto concrete with very little padding. That works up a sweat.
Yeah.
And some very sore knees.
Yeah.
And I was especially, I guess, entertained at that point because you're too tired to be angry. Because I'm taking notes like a madman as I'm going through the story mode. This was before folks were uploading videos as reliably on YouTube as they do nowadays.
Yeah.
So I'm scribbling down notes, and the... what's the word I'm looking for? Calibrating screen before every race comes up. And I'm like, well, I'm sitting down. I'm writing these notes. Never mind. I'll lose this race and just do it again later. So it goes through the calibration with me sitting, okay? At this point, my shoulder should be reading as my knees. It should not work. The race starts. I'm still sitting there writing. I came in fourth.
Yeah.
I actively try to play the game. 8th place, 12th place, try again, stupid. Sitting there.
Yeah, you just sit there and do nothing, and the game works better. That's, yeah.
So I never actually finished it, and ended up having to go off of other people's playthroughs for the information, but I never did try the 2-player co-op mode. I think that might have saved my marriage, so.
Saved your marriage? Yeah.
Well, because we never had to go through that trial together.
Oh, okay, okay. I thought you said you had gone through it.
No. No, I would not subject another human being to that, let alone my beloved wife.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
So, yeah, less Free Riders, more Sonic R. Give me back my Sonic R. Cheesy yeah. music, maybe some light platforming elements. Put everybody on their feet. I'd be happy.
I think with the running style, the gameplay style that we have in, like, or at least that we've had recently and stuff like Sonic Generations and Sonic Unleashed, I think that could work. That style could work for more of a racing game.
Sure. Now, the question would be whether you would need a button for acceleration or have everyone auto-accelerate and use the button for special commands, but we could wax philosophically about this all day. Let's get back to the actual topic, which is racing games.
Oh, yeah. Hey, we were talking Sonic R. That's a racing game in my book. But yes... racing games. What other... Actually, let me tell you about a racing game that isn't even out yet that I'm really enjoying because I'm playing the alpha of it right now.
Ooh, are you allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, there's no... Luckily, there's no NDR on it. Or NDA. I don't know, NDR? No, I was thinking to do not resuscitate. Man, that's terrible. That's terrible. That's awful. I'm a horrible person. Just in case you guys weren't aware, I'm awful.
Well, I laughed at it, so that makes me just as bad. Anyway.
Okay. It's all good. It's all fine then. But no, there's a game coming out soon called Drift Stage. And it's absolutely a gorgeous game. Sort of in the style of maybe classic Sega arcade games like OutRun. And also a little bit of Ridge Racer, I'd say, which is, of course, Namco, Sony. But still, it's definitely one of those things where I look at it, man, I'm just thinking, like, man, this game should have been out in the arcades in the early 90s. It would have sat comfortably alongside Daytona USA and Ridge Racer and been a lot of fun. But basically what it is an arcade-style racing game with facsimiles of real cars. They aren't licensed cars, but they're very much heavily based on real-life cars.
If you know cars, you know what they're supposed to be.
Yeah, and it's drenched in 80s style, and the look of it is just gorgeous. I love it. And it's very pixel art-ish, even though the game is in 3D. The game uses 3D polygons and rendering and stuff, but the art style is kind of an 8-bit.
I get you, I get
8-bit look. And there's a lot of neon and bright colors, and it's just gorgeous. And right now, unfortunately, it's still in alpha, which means the only thing that's really available is a time trial mode. But even the time trial mode is just a lot of fun. The recent alpha release has new physics, which are spot on for arcade-style racing games. It's approachable, but challenging. The old adage, easy to use but difficult to master, kind of applies to this.
I was just about to say that, but you beat me to the finish line.
Yep. And it kind of has sort of a synthwave aesthetic, and the soundtrack is phenomenal. It's got jazz fusion, 80s style synthwave based on like 80s movies and stuff. The soundtrack is one of those things where I just listen to it all the time at this point because it's glorious. Composed by someone who I am unfortunately need to get more familiar with, but due to this soundtrack has quickly become one of my favorite people to listen to stuff from, Hugh Myrone, or just Myrone as he's known. His stuff is excellent. So if you want to go check out the game, check out driftstagegame.com. And they aren't paying for this placement, by the way. It's just a recent racing game that I've been playing around a lot with recently, and I've just been really enjoying, and I really, really want to play the full version.
Do they have a timetable, or is this just as it comes?
As it comes. It's an indie game. And I think right now a lot of the really good racing game stuff is coming out of the indie scene. So
indie scene really is filling a lot of gaps that the major publishers are lacking in. So
yeah, there's a game called the 90s Arcade Racer, which was on Kickstarter. Let me see. Back in 2013. And it's unfortunately still not out yet, but it's very much a game designed to be in the spirit of classic Sega racing games. It looks pretty much just like Daytona USA 2 or Indy 500 or Sega Super GT. It even lists those three games in the Kickstarter as the main inspiration for it. And
but with a title like that, it's a little on the nose. So right, at least you know what you're getting.
Right, and it looks gorgeous. You can go look at the car renders, and they just look fantastic. The tracks are beautiful. I'm looking forward to that one for sure. The last update was in 2015, though, interesting. So I hope we hear more about that one soon.
Absolutely. Well, have we driven this topic into the ground? Should we move on to the Q&A section?
Yep, I think it's about time we get to some Q&A goodness.
Alrighty. Well, we have no Patreon ads this week. That's too bad. But we do have some Patreon priority Q&A, don't we, Kyle?
Yes, we do. We got two questions. This first one is from Samuel Parales. Mega Man's characterization was one of my favorite/underrated aspects of the comic. Back when you first started writing Mega Man, You once mentioned in a podcast that writing for Mega Man himself was one of the most challenging parts of the book. Do you feel that by issue 55, you got more comfortable with finding the right voice for him?
I do. I think I eventually got into his head and found a comfortable voice for him. The challenge I had later on, and what I would have had going forward, was that the way the book was paced and the way that we were approaching some of the challenges, it would be very, very hard to maintain the degree of simpleness and naivete that he has to carry on throughout the series. We were coming up on Mega Man 4, which is, you know, the Dr. Cossack storyline. And by that point, Mega Man had seen a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And we would still need him to be in a position to believe, you know, when Bass shows up, all black and gold and menacing. It's like, oh, you say you're a friendly robot. Okay. And that kind of thing. So I think ultimately his desire to believe in the best of people and his general good-natured self would help with a lot of that, but I was already starting to feel a lot of the crunch from here is the formula, here's the eight robot masters, here's the Wily Castle, rinse, repeat. How do you make that into an interesting and engaging storyline over and over again? It would have been a challenge to confront. I think we would have gotten through it.
Yeah.
And I will relish the opportunity to get back into the saddle and try that again. Just because it's a challenge doesn't necessarily mean that's a bad thing. So I definitely feel like I was more confident with his voice, and that would help me going forward.
I think one of the things I really enjoyed was the way you started integrating earlier on some of the characters that were introduced in those later games, like Dr. Cossack and some of the robot masters from later games. They started showing up earlier, which was very fitting and sort of made the storylines make a little more sense if you only know the storylines from the games, like how all the Mega Man 9 robot masters were up for retirement. And it's like, well, we've never seen them before. How do I even know that? But, well, now you've, with the comic, you sort of worked with that and brought them, at least some of them, back earlier.
I mean, that was pretty much everything I did, especially in the first few arcs, was purposefully to build a foundation for the later games. Having Dr. Cossack show up so much earlier and be such a supportive, positive force was supposed to make the Mega Man 4 storyline that much more powerful.
Yeah.
Because Dr. Cossack actually meant something.
Right.
Kalinka's peril actually meant something to you.
Yeah.
And having other characters like Dr. Lalinde and Dr. Kuin and Dr. Cossack and Dr. Asil, you know, having these other creators around the world was to not only make the world feel bigger and fuller, but when we got to, oh shoot, was it Mega Man 6 that was the world tournament?
With
Centaur Man and all that?
Yes, that was it. With Plant Man, yeah.
Yeah, so that would make sense that there would be these other robot masters not built by Dr. Light.
Right, yeah.
So, I don't know, maybe we'll get around to it. Never say never.
Yeah, that's one of the things I actually kind of like too, was you took existing robot masters, but then made them not necessarily created by one of two people. Like Plant Man. I thought that was really, really cool.
And major props to Capcom for letting me get away with so much, you know, with their IP.
Yeah. All right, let's get one more Patreon priority Q&A question in here from Daniel Luna. This one's actually been floating around for a while, unfortunately. I kind of missed it the first time when it first got posted, so sorry about that, Daniel. Anyway, long-time listener, first-time caller. I didn't know he was calling. But he wants to know, what do you guys think the thinking was by DC having the Suicide Squad being the fun, lucky movie and Batman v Superman, the dark and gritty movie? Do you think there's any redemption for their cinematic universe?
This is actually interesting because I just read a news article related to this, and it's a continuing to develop story, but it boils down to how Warner Brothers DC was approaching their superhero staple versus how Disney Marvel was approaching theirs.
Yeah.
Disney Marvel is very much a top-down driven cinematic universe where you've got Marvel with both hands firmly on the steering wheel, creating this largely cohesive cinematic universe. DC had their approach of let the directors tell their stories and it will all fall into place, which led to Zack Snyder's Superman, Batman v Superman, and then the apparent very tonally different Suicide Squad. And as of today, Snyder is no longer in executive control of the cinematic universe. Geoff Johns, who is positively legendary within DC, now has a major hand in it too, and it looks like they're shifting to more of a Marvel model. So I think the reason why the two films are going to be so different in terms of tone is because that's just the way the directors were handling it.
Yeah.
I don't think it was necessarily a overarching decision. I think that's just the way that's how they were handling it, which is fine. That makes enough sense. I mean, to each their own. I wouldn't say, I hate to use the word salvage because it makes it sound like that this is some kind of overarching, already conceived deal. Because even on the Marvel side, where they have their multiple phases of films, we know that things can change. Spider-Man was off the table entirely, and now he's getting a film before Black Panther, and they've been building Black Panther for a while.
Yeah.
So it's not like you can say, this camp won or this camp's losing or whatnot, because it's not that clean cut. In terms of, can the DC cinematic universe match the breadth and the scope and the cohesion of the Marvel universe? Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we only have two films in, and with a different director, a different writer, and a different way of approaching the films, there's a ton of stuff to be built from. Batman v Superman was basically the Iron Man to the franchise. It set everything up, and from now they'll build off of that.
Yeah, I think that it was definitely a separate. They were definitely sort of separated from each other, I think. There was not really this overarching tone established like there was with Marvel. So, I mean, pretty basic. But I definitely saw the news. I saw the news about Geoff Johns getting brought in and Zack Snyder. I think Zack Snyder at this point is basically just going to be like on set on the movies, but he's not going to do anything.
Like, let me put it another way. Looking at the Marvel Cinematic Universe,
mm-hmm.
The two Thor films, they're fun, but they're not great.
Yeah, Avengers 2. I enjoyed them, but yeah.
Not that great of a film. I mean, it served a purpose, but it's just kind of there.
Yeah.
But overall, you view it as an excellent exercise in bringing these properties to the big screen. So if Wonder Woman is as good as her cameo was, if Aquaman is awesome, if Flash is awesome, if all these other films are strong on their own, if Justice League comes together really well, Batman v Superman is not going to be the albatross that sinks the entire thing. Folks are going to be a little more tepid going in, maybe, but as soon as you win their confidence, they're going to keep coming back for more. Like right. I said, Thor wasn't amazing. Iron Man 3 was kind of lacking. But people don't look at the franchises overall and go, eh. They're willing to go for a little bit more. Maybe that's me projecting something, but I would definitely think there's a future for the DC DC Cinematic Universe. Excuse me.
I think you're right. The X-Men franchise kind of went through some of the same thing where where we had X-Men 3, which was
if they can survive X3 and the Wolverine, DC can survive.
Yeah, X-Men Origins Wolverine almost killed it off, I think. But when they came back with First Class, they really, I think, got their groove back. So that's definitely another one where you kind of look at it overall and realize, it works. It comes together and it's really good. But there's a few things here and there where it doesn't quite work out, but taken at the grander picture, I think ultimately the DC Cinematic Universe will ultimately, I'm really hopeful, be a good thing. All right, that's going to do it for the priority Q&A.
If you want to be part of the priority Q&A, head over to patreon.com /Bumblecast. Toss us a few bucks, 5 actually, and get in the queue, and we will answer your questions before everybody else.
Yes, yes, yes. Now, let's get into some standard Q&A. I've got one here from our good friend, Lord Laharl's Vassal.
Say that one 3 times fast.
Lord Laharl's Vassal, Lord Laharl's Vassal, Lord Laharl's Vassal. Blah, 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 blah. Anyway, would it be legal for you to get a bit more into the backstory of Fixit?
How to dance around this one. I personally believe that legally, yes, we should be free and clear, but others may not agree. So I think it's better to just not even go there. That and Fixit is not meant to be a central figure anyway. He's supposed to be a supporting character of a supporting character. He's an adorable little goofball off to the side. So folks know what he is. Fans can put the pieces together themselves. For now, there's a whole lot more for me to go in other directions with other characters.
Alrighty. Next question is from Unknown Shadow 675. Are there still Shadow androids? What do you think happened to them after the events of Shadow's game?
The absolutely unrestrained fanboy in me says, no, 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 there's some somewhere, and they're doing this, and we can do this with them, and we can tell the story, and the practical side of me is going, no, they're gone. The Chaotix destroyed a large number of them in Sonic Heroes, and then I imagine the rest were destroyed by Shadow and the general conflict with the Black Arms invasion. I would love the opportunity to take a Shadow android and maybe expound upon that. But last time I tried to introduce the Shadow androids, Sega of Japan was not too keen on the idea. And now we have Eclipse, who is already that kind of quasi-Shadow figure that I feel a Shadow android would kind of be retreading that ground a bit. So maybe we would bring them up out of obscurity one day, but for right now, let's just say they've all been destroyed because they got blown up. That's just how it goes.
Sometimes things just get blown up.
It's just what happens.
It's just a thing that happens. I mean, sometimes you just go outside and sometimes the thing's blown up.
It's sad, but true.
Yeah. It's weird, but it happens.
I can't wait for this to like become outdated in like 3 months and somebody write in a question saying, you said you were going to use Shadow androids. It's like, I said, probably not. Just work with me.
You said you weren't going to use Shadow androids, but then you were. Then you did. It's fine. Whatever. Tell him to embrace the Shadow androids.
Not too much. They've got cannons for arms.
Ah, whatever. Remember, they explode. Anyway, we got a question here from Tabby. She wants to know, this is a very deep lore question from the previous continuity, so
put on your spelunking gear.
Here we go. Let's see if we can dredge up some memories here. When Sally was mad at Max, which I assume would be King Max, she came off harsh toward Hershey at first, but explained herself quickly after. Then when Hershey and Jeffrey were asking Mina about the sword of acorns and Hershey suggested she talk to her, Jeffrey started yelling but quickly cut himself off when he realized who he was talking to. Why?
I think you stumped me on this one.
Uh-oh.
The question itself, I'm not quite sure who the pronouns are going to towards the end.
I think he means, or I think, let's see, Jeffrey started yelling. I think when Jeffrey was yelling at Hershey, maybe?
See, I don't immediately recall any interactions between Jeffrey, Hershey, and Mina anyway. So unless this was back, way back when the Sword of Acorns was kind of in play with Kodos, but even then, I don't think Hershey was that active of a member of the Secret Service yet. I think that came a little later, so I don't know. I would kind of need issue numbers to reference and reread. That's water so far under the bridge, I'm afraid it's gone out to sea. I don't know.
Sorry about that, Tabby. if you want to get in touch with me and maybe clarify a little bit, give us some more reference to work with, we can do that one again.
Unless it's one of those things where it's like, I wasn't sure what the writer was going for initially, and we just kind of had to move on from there, because that, you know, the very beginning of my run on the book was a whole lot of consolidation and trying to rationalize the directions of multiple writers.
Right.
At the same time. I forget how it was configured, but somebody went through The Darkest Storm and came up with 32 different plot lines that I ended or resolved or tied together. Which probably explains why that three-part story is so freaking dense. Yeah. And nobody really likes it. Well, they like it for all the, you know, battles and stuff, because when else are you going to see the Freedom Fighters and the Chaotix fight Spider Ninjas and Mogul and Nagas and all them? Blah, 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 blah. But it was a very, very dense story, and that's because I was pretty much given those three issues to wrap up almost as much as I could from the past 15 years of book. So, you know, yeah. not everything is going to get answered. Not every T is going to be topped off. Not every I is going to be dotted. So T is going to be crossed. This term is T. Let's move on before I make myself sound any more stupid.
I'm just wondering if this was from a point in the book where you were writing it or if it was a previous writer. That's one of the things.
See, I don't remember Jeffrey and Hershey and Mina interacting all that much anyway, even during my run. So, because yeah. I think Mina was kind of on tour for the most part until the Iron Dominion and the fallout from that. And
I don't remember.
I don't remember.
Anyway. All right, we got one last question from the Fat Panda. Are the history of the Gizoids?
I always said Gizoids.
Gizoids, okay. Are the history of the Gizoids going to be expanded upon at any point? And are you likely to do your own take on it, considering a pretty major aspect of their in-game history is off-limits?
That's dangerous territory that I would rather not wade into. Because if I go my own route, let's say, and then things outside of my influence are resolved or move in a certain direction, then I'm in a very precarious situation where I have to retcon myself pretty hardcore. And if I don't touch it, then it stays in this stable little limbo where the fans can draw their own conclusions and nothing is broken, everything's fine. So I'd rather do that.
That works.
Unless Sega comes in with something new, like if they come out with a new game that completely contradicts Dark Brotherhood and kind of paves over it, in which that case, you know, full steam ahead, that's the new canon.
Yeah.
So it goes.
Yeah. All right. Well, that does it for this Q&A segment. How you feeling, Ian?
I'm feeling pretty good. Before we move into the final plugs, let's give a shout out to everyone who made this episode possible.
All right.
Give a big thank you to S. Yovarovich, 9X, Daniel H., Daniel L., Samuel P., Justin G., Connell T., James K., Patty M., and Alex P. Thank you so much, guys, for being there for us every week, every month, every day. Always in your thoughts. Always with us in your hearts. Did I lay that on a little thicker? Is that going to be okay?
It's all good. I'm okay with it, man. I'm okay. I'm cool. I'm not really that cool, but you know what I mean. Anyway, I think that's going to do it for this edition of the Bumblecast.
If you want to follow anything from me, go to bumbleking.com or follow me on Twitter at IanFlynnBKC. And if you are in the Charlotte, North Carolina neck of the woods on June 17th, 18th, and 19th, come on down to Heroes Con at the Convention Center. See me, Aaliyah Baker, Chad Thomas, Tracy Yardley, Jim Amish, and Adam Bryce Thomas. We got to have a lot of Sonic folks there this year.
Can I go? I'd like to go.
Come on down!
I want to go, but I'm like thousands of miles away.
They have airplanes.
I'm thousands of miles away. Also, time is a thing. You can find me over at kngi.org, the KNGI network. I'm going to be starting a series of shows for the month of June celebrating Sonic. Because June is Sonic's 25th anniversary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
So I think it's high time I do a series of shows dedicated to Sonic. Who knows, maybe we'll do a Bumblecast dedicated to Sonic one of these days. We haven't done that yet. What do you think, Ian?
I think it's about time. We've avoided it this long, so this wasn't, you know, Ian's Sonic show. So sure, why not?
Sure. I mean, hey, it's 25th anniversary. We've got to talk about him at least a little bit. And, of course, you can follow me over on Twitter at KyleJCRB to get the latest updates of what's going on over at the KNGI Network and what's going on with me. And I'm thinking about going to Phoenix Comic Con. I believe it's next weekend. At least one day, probably Sunday. So if you happen to be in the Phoenix area or attending Phoenix Comic Con, look around. Maybe you'll recognize my voice somewhere. and that's going to do it, I believe.
So this was Bumblecast episode 18 for May 30th. We'll see you again on June 13th for Bumblecast episode 19.
All right, see y'all later.
Bye. And things exploded.
Don't they always? I don't know what that was.
Random thought. You remember when there was that whole slew of bike horn covers for various songs? Is there any way, yes. Is there any kind of auto thingy where we could plug in the Bumblecast theme to do car horns?
If I had like a... If I had a MIDI of it, which I don't, unfortunately, we could do something like that.
Oh well, it was a thought.
Oh man, that's terrible. But I like it. I like it. Hey, thanks for listening to the Bumblecast. If you like the show, be sure to hit that subscribe button and consider supporting us on Patreon. We have some great rewards as well as big plans to make the show even better. Also, rate and review the show on iTunes. It gets more folks listening and really helps us out, so we definitely appreciate it. Original music by Ken Coda Snyder, used with permission. Find more of his music at bc.s3m.us and find the theme song at noisechanradio.bandcamp.com, available as a pay-what-you-want download.